Access to Live show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of the integrative cancer care charity Yes to Life, working to bring the benefits of integrative medicine to people with cancer in the UK for over 20 years. During those two decades, the skill sets of practitioners in this field have grown exponentially, and there are many more highly trained practitioners available now to meet the growing demand that's driven by the rising numbers being diagnosed, but also by rising awareness of the importance of broadening the scope of therapeutic approaches to embrace mind, body and spirit. Dr. Saskia Kloppenburg is one such highly skilled practitioner working in the UK, and today I'm going to be speaking to her on a range of topics around the important question of when to introduce integrative modalities. Hi Saskia, delighted to welcome you to the Yes to Life show.
Hi Robin, thank you so much for having me.
So today we're going to be talking about timing, when the right time is to embrace integrative medicine, and we're going to go into some detail about the why behind that, looking at the aspects of our being that require our attention if we're aiming to keep the very best opportunities for healing. But particularly, as this is the first time that you've been on the show, I'd love to know a little bit more about you, how you came to be an integrative practitioner, and what inspires and interests you the most.
Oh, of course. So by training, I'm a consultant in general internal medicine. So I specialized in Spain. I worked there for 5 years as a consultant during my consultancy training. And I think it was there where my passion for the holistic view started, because in general internal medicine, we have very complicated patients, above 60, 70, heart failure, kidney failure, sepsis, sometimes online diagnosis and lots of symptoms. So it's quite complicated, which means that I naturally already envisage the whole body, not only the heart like a cardiologist or the kidneys like the nephrologist. It was already the whole body. But what was missing there, and I realized this during my first year, was the mind and the spirit. And I realized that because I would say 95 to 99% of the patients, when I would do the medical history and I would ask, like, when did your symptoms start? They naturally would say something like, oh, when I retired, or when I got divorced, or when I lost my son, or when I lost my husband. And it was so natural. But I started to think, well, they give you a starting point where conventional medicine doesn't make the link. So that's where my interest in that area started.
Very interesting. Yes, you're right. And the people themselves have made that connection, and it's not just as a reference point where they say in time, it's actually an event, and they're connecting it with their state of health. So that's the sort of thing we should pick up on, obviously, and which you've clearly done. Yeah. So this started you off with an interest in integrative medicine. What ways did you pursue that?
Well, as a child, I was treated with homeopathy. Mm-hmm. I think I took my first antibiotic when I was 20-something, my early 20s. So I always knew that it does work. But when I started medical school, I thought, well, I kind of abandoned homeopathy. But then I came back to it. And homeopathy does take into account the emotions. Mm. So I started that. I did a 4-year master's degree in Barcelona and then in the MFO in the UK. And then I also, because I had initially, years ago, I had a spider phobia, which was quite limited. It did affect me quite significantly. I got to know about hypnotherapy and the effectiveness of it. So, and then I did a master's degree in neurolinguistic programming. and Ericksonian hypnotherapy, and which I found so powerful to do. I mean, Milton Erickson used to say that it's never too late to have a happy childhood. So I became to know the power firsthand with my patients to see how I can help them and how it would change them, the underlying emotions, the traumas. It's very, very interesting.
I take it worked for the spiders too.
It did.
Right.
It absolutely did.
Otherwise, you wouldn't have been so convinced.
No, it did. I used to, when I used to see a spider, I would almost faint, like almost faint. But no, now I can take a spider and a glass and a paper and just...
Yeah, deal with that. Yeah. Yeah. Amazing, eh? Amazing. Right. Okay. And I think you've gone on from there. Obviously, you know, you're now working with people with cancer and things. So you've obviously gone much further since then.
Yes, it has a bit of a journey because I also did a master's degree in nutrition, a three-year master's degree in nutrition in Barcelona. But then in 2014, I started working at the NHS, at the Royal London Hospital for Integrated Medicine. And I, because as a consultant, you know, I've sometimes been, I've felt a bit like, not belittled, but my colleagues wouldn't take me as serious as I would have liked.
Right.
So, you know, she uses herbs to treat things. And so I was always very much into research and always very much into measurables, into variables that could be measured objectively. So this took me unknowingly into the cancer departments where a lot of regular imaging tumor markers would have been done. And then because a post became available, and I think it's things of the universe, I started working there at the complementary cancer care department at the RLHIM.
Right. I didn't know you'd work there. Mm. Okay. So is it right to say you've got to focus on cancer patients at this point? Is it?
Only see cancer patients.
Only see cancer patients, right. Okay. Well, that's amazing. And so I want to talk a little bit about the journey of people with cancer in this country because, you know, certainly from my point of view, integrative medicine isn't really a thing here yet, integrative oncology. It's still largely piecemeal and people have to do it for themselves. And they're very much unsupported, really, in investigations into integrative oncology. I got a kind of a bit of a long view now, having been doing this for 20 years, and some things have got better. You know, there are more people working to help people with cancer now, without doubt, especially as there's special courses for nutrition and things which actually specifically talk about working with cancer, which was definitely a no-no in the past. But on the other hand, we have the really rapidly moving science of integrative oncology, and it's getting more and more complex very quickly. I mean, it's nothing like it was 10 years ago. You know, looking back then, it seems like it was really simple. It wasn't, but compared to now, it was. I mean, what's your feeling? Do you feel that overall things are getting better for people with cancer in this country from that perspective?
I think so, because as everything new in science, first it is belittled or not taken seriously or ridiculized even, but it's a phase that it seems like everything goes through at the beginning, but there's plenty of research and the research is inspiring. It's every time, every day we have more research papers. Better quality. It's not only case reports. Now we have clinical trials, placebo-controlled, phase two and even phase three clinical trials. And it's proving what it has indicated at the beginning is that many complementary therapies such as the mistletoe therapy or high-dose vitamin C or other complementary therapies, they are just helping patients. And it's so important because it should not be viewed as an alternative. Absolutely not. Complementary therapies, as the name itself explains, it's complement. It does complement the conventional medicine, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, surgery, immunotherapy, hormone therapy. And it has shown to make the patient's journey easier. It improves quality of life. But not only that, it's very importantly also, there's some research showing that some complementary therapies do improve the efficacy of the chemotherapy. There's a very nice trial, phase two clinical trial published, I think was the end of last year, in pancreatic cancer stage 4, treated with nab-paclitaxel and gemcitabine, and alongside this treated with high-dose vitamin C, where the progression-free survival time doubled.
Amazing.
In the group that had combined therapies. And not only that, the toxicity was reduced. Patients did tolerate the chemotherapy much better. They needed less pauses or less dose reduction of the chemotherapy. And less toxicity, we say this so quick, less toxicity means less neuropathy. And neuropathy is a very debilitating side effect because it damages the nerve endings for a long time. And I've only seen a few patients recovering fully from neuropathy. And peripheral neuropathy has a huge impact in patients' quality of life. It's not like nausea that you go through. Yes, of course, it's better not to have the nausea, but it passes and you recover.
It goes away, yeah. And
there are things that stay forever. Cardiotoxicity, doxycycline. There is side effects that we can reduce or even prevent with complementary therapy, and that's so important.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the really exciting things, which is quite recent, really, that we've moved beyond the alternative conventional divide, and we've actually found the ways of which these things can really work together, which is quite exciting. It's a whole new field in a way, just because it wasn't even possible in the past. But people are doing it. The research is out there. And as you say, there's some major minuses to conventional treatments. I mean, as you say, those damaging effects are things that can make the remaining life that somebody gets from the treatment quite difficult, you know. And so you think, well, okay, they're alive, but they might be suffering all the time. And so if we can do anything about that, well, that's massive. But I think the real gem in it is what you describe, is that you put these things together and it actually works better. I mean, that's just amazing, isn't it? And you wouldn't even suspect that was going to happen necessarily. It's quite unpredictable, the fact that such a thing would happen. But it's not that uncommon now that they're coming up with combinations of natural products and normal drugs and chemotherapy, et cetera, or radiotherapy, and getting an improved result with the combination. It's exciting.
Yes, that's true. But also, like with the new immunotherapy or targeted therapies that are discovered or designed, they are trialed in combination with the currently available chemotherapy. And this is because when research is designed, it's not ethical to say to a group of patients with a diagnosis, or you're not having the already available chemotherapy because we have a new drug. We want to try how well it works. It's not ethical to do that. So it has to be trialed in combination with the new immunotherapy. That's why nowadays most patients get chemo and immunotherapy, or chemotherapy and targeted therapy. And the same is happening with complementary therapies. In the past 10, 20 years ago, a lot of oncologists would say, oh, complementary therapies, there's no evidence for it. There's always been evidence, maybe not in such quality, but because there's also restriction in funding. Also restriction how to publish papers, and I can tell you a personal story a bit later. But the lack of evidence, there is various reasons behind that. But coming back to the topic is that nowadays there's a lot of clinical trials in progress or being designed which are in combination with the chemotherapy because of that, because now it's much better understood how complementary therapies can help patients.
Yeah, well, that's a good move.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, ant and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Let's get on now to that matter of timing I mentioned at the beginning. There's one thing that makes my heart sink is when someone with cancer says, well, I'll get my treatment in the hospital over and done with, and then I'll start to look at all that stuff. And I don't hear that as much as I used to, I have to say, thankfully, but it's still around. And I expect we're in absolute agreement that this is a tragically mistaken view to hold. Do you want to explain why?
Yes, I completely agree. It's true that we have more and more patients coming saying, oh, I've just been diagnosed and I'm looking outside the hospital. What else can I do? That's happening more and more. But also we have so many patients who say, oh, stage four, nothing else the hospital can do for me. What can you do? Well, I mean, yes, I can help you. But if you had come earlier, I could have done so much better. There's many, many different things. There is a combination. So it's always a holistic approach. It's always about, I say the three main pillars are the mind, the body, and the soul. And when it comes to the body, we have nutrition, there's supplements, there's physical exercise. Then there is complementary therapies like IV therapies, there's acupuncture, there's reflexology, there is off-label drugs. There's so many different things that are being researched and tried at the moment that do help. And I always say the more you do, the better the chances of having a good outcome. The second pillar is the mind. And there is one very, very important thing that I think is missed very, very often, which is that the actual diagnosis that when patients receive the diagnosis, there very often I think there is a post-traumatic stress syndrome. The impact that they receive of this diagnosis, which often implies a death sentence, patients go into fight and flight mode. And when that happens, the subconscious mind memorizes everything around you, the noise, the smell, the sound, the voices, the sensations, everything. So it can alert you if in the future you get in a similar situation. The subconscious mind will give you heart rate, you'll start to sweat. This is to make you feel uncomfortable so you leave that environment. This is biological survival.
Yeah.
Survival mechanism. But the problem is that patients are meant to go back to the hospital to receive the treatment and not back into this environment where they have received this death sentence and the body goes straight back into fight and flight mode, which is counterproductive for the therapy, for the treatment they're having at the hospital. So I think it's so important to address that as well as...
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. Okay. So, so on the timing though, the thing is, now is always the right time. It's the way I look at it when it comes to integrative medicine. It's the right time to start right now because, yeah, if you've just been diagnosed, brilliant. But if you're in mid-treatment and you're not doing it, well, come on, get on with it. And if there's nothing else you can do, well, also, you might as well do this.
Yes. I mean, I think the best time is prevention.
Absolutely right.
That's the best thing. The second best is ASAP, as soon as you can, as soon as you have the diagnosis, as soon as you know what the treatment plan is. Because we have patients who contact our clinic and then say, oh, I want to look into it. Yes, but first you need to speak with your oncologist and I need to know the treatment plan. Because it's very, very important for me as a consultant in integrated oncology to know what chemotherapy or hormone therapy or target therapy the patient is getting.
Yeah.
I design the treatment plan so that we don't interfere. So there's some supplements or therapies that can interfere with some chemo immunotherapies. And the last thing I want to do is to interfere. So it's very, very
absolutely
to have the plan and then look out.
Yeah. Well, that thing you said about, prevention, one of the powerful things about lifestyle medicine, if we call it that, is the fact that unlike other forms of medicine, which change radically depending on whether you're well, ill, whatever you are, or post-treatment, lifestyle medicine gives the same message all the time. If you do good stuff, you live well, it's good for you. And you might turn the volume up if you've got cancer, but it's still the same message, actually, isn't it, all the time. Always supportive, always positive, always helping your body to do its best given the circumstances. So that's a powerful thing to me because it's a single message and it always applies.
Yes. The problem is that we don't take it seriously until it's too late, unfortunately.
The human condition, you're right. We need some horrible kick up the backside before we actually take it seriously. Yeah, well, we're all a bit like that. The people are not like that, a few and far between. But anyway, what to do? Yes, but even so, if you've had the diagnosis, well, it is exactly the right moment to get on and bring in everything you can. And as you point out, one of the first things that happens to you is you get an existential threat, which is maybe something right beyond anything that's happened to you before and creates a state of mind which you've not encountered before. And that is something to deal with, is inevitably going to have a negative effect in all sorts of different ways as you go along if you don't address it in some way.
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, also, coming back to the second pillar of the holistic treatment, addressing the traumas, not only the traumas of the diagnosis, but also looking, just checking if there is anything in the past that may have contributed to the diagnosis. And it's a box ticking. I always say, just look, do soul work and just see if there is something, because if there is something, we can work on it. And because I have had cases where patients, as I said at the beginning, they link the diagnosis with a event. And it's so personal. It's not like, I'm not saying that every diagnosis does have an emotional cause. I'm not, absolutely not saying that. But it is true, and there's so much research out there that emotional trauma can contribute. It prepares the terrain to then get ill. And we have to also look at the terrain before we just treat the diagnosis. We have to address the whole person. That does include if there is past traumas or if there is the stress management. I mean, we're talking about different areas. We're talking about the stress of being diagnosed. We're talking about any possible traumas that have happened in the past. But we're also talking about the stress from the diagnosis onwards, hospital, blood tests, scans. How do I prepare for a scan? Oh my God, I will have a scan. What will it say? 3 weeks, 4 weeks, waiting time until to get the results. That's a lot of stress for the patient.
Mm. Well, we've got enough science now to know for a fact that how we are in life is we're optimistic, forward-looking, or we're depressed. Or, you know, these actually have a major effect on our immunity, on our whole biological system. And, you know, the days of trying to pretend it didn't matter, it was nothing to do with it, are over, I think. You know, the people are still trying to pretend that. But, in fact, you and I know the science is all there. It's definitely the case. So if you want to get out of a situation where your life's under threat, well, you want your biology to be at its best, basically, don't you? And so, yeah, if you don't address fundamental trauma from the past that you've never dealt with, maybe, or you don't address the fear that's come with the cancer diagnosis, you're just giving yourself a further obstacle to get over. So, yeah, it kind of makes complete sense. It's a funny conundrum, this one, is that, that many people realize that it's important that their relationship to fear and everything, but And it could have even played a big part, as you say, in contributing to their condition. But nonetheless, cancer itself and the treatment around it is just generating more and more as you go on. So in a way, if you're not well equipped to deal with that, it's in danger of taking you down. And this is the treatments, it's the many of the practitioners around you, and or your family might have a negative attitude towards your situation. Either you're doing the wrong thing, or they're convinced you're going to die, and therefore they're already grieving for you while you're still alive. There's so many difficult things for people to deal with, and to remain buoyant in the face of it. It's an immense challenge.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There's different factors. It's very, very important to be able to look at these factors, withdrawing yourself from the first person view. I don't know if I'm explaining myself.
No, I understand. You're being objective about your own situation. Yes. Yes.
It's very difficult, especially when family is involved, because the family have their own fear of losing.
Yes.
Someone they're close with, so they want to do everything, and because they may have different belief system or they don't agree with what the patient wants, they try to convince and push, or they look for many thousands of things and then overwhelm the patient and know what to do, where to go, and that causes more stress. And with all my love, I say you need to speak openly with your family and just agree on and understanding that also the family doesn't do it with the intention to overwhelm you. They do it out of love.
Sure.
It's purely out of love. And that comprehension and that compassion, it's very important to reach that state instead of going into a state of resisting and feeling overwhelmed and stressed. So this is what I mean with just stepping out of the feeling and just being the observer of how you feel. That gives a lot of peace already.
Interesting. Quite unusually, you're equipped with various therapy types you've trained in, which can actually help with the mental state, as well as being able to help nutritionally or with a complementary therapies you've described. There's quite a range of things you've got on offer. So useful to be able to assess them all at the same time in the same place, because as I say, one of the bugbears of integrated medicine in the UK is you end up going all over the place to see all sorts of different people to get different parts. It's sort of DIY integrative therapy.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movements and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
maybe do you want to just talk a little bit about how you, when you have a new patient coming to you, and you're building a picture to yourself of where you're going to prioritize your support, and with these different skills of yours, and as you say, the different arenas that problems can be in, either very practical or very intangible, maybe. How do you assess and decide where to place the pull?
That's a very interesting, very complex question, because even though I go through patients' files before I speak with them for the first time, I kind of divide my mind. I have the knowledge of what the patient's case is, the diagnosis, the treatment they're going to have, or they have had or having at the moment. But then I try to leave that in one place and still keep a white piece of paper, blank mind, and just allow the patient to tell me their story. Because how they phrase things and what they say and the way they say it gives me a lot of information. And sometimes it can tell me where the pain is or what the most urgent part is that requires to be addressed. I've had patients say to me that I connect with them and I make them cry in a positive way, in terms of I go right to where the most urgent area is, but in some way. But the thing is, when I design the treatment plan, I take so many different things into account, and it's very complex. And that is what makes my approach quite unique, because it's not one size fits all. It's about nutrition, but then nutrition, I give general advice, but then our patients who have, they're like a different cuisine, they're from a different culture, or they're allergic to some food, and then it doesn't work. My general advice, and I individualize. And then there is physical exercise. I recommend what type of exercise and how to exercise, targeted or tailored to that patient's need, because it's very, very important that the patients do actually enjoy their treatment. They have to enjoy their diet. They have to enjoy the physical exercise. They have to enjoy all the techniques that I teach to manage the stress. Because if it's just a to-do list, it doesn't help at all. What point is it if I ask the patient to walk out in the woods if they don't like it?
Right.
It's
makes sense.
We have to individualize here.
Yeah, right. So you're trying to find things that actually, really appeal to them. Actually, it's not... you're looking for where their interests lie, where their affinities lie, in order to be able to know what to prescribe. It sounds like a very intuitive process in many ways. I mean, you talked about all the sort of working out with the treatments and all the rest of it at the beginning, the science bit. But this in itself, you're talking about a very intuitive process, which involves some deep listening, which is rather different. But
I think it is difficult because... As I explained at the beginning, when I started going off the path of just conventional medicine, I felt I had to back up with a lot of research when I was explaining what I want to do with colleagues, just sharing that. There was always this, but this is not evidence-based. Yes, it is. There is loads of PubMed research papers. You just have to go there and look for it. So I had the natural, I still have, a very natural drive to everything evidence-based. But this is also, it is tricky because I think it was my second year in specialist training, I had to speak in front of a lot of people, given a talk about, I can't remember which inhaler it was, and I had to do all the literature review about that inhaler. What does the literature say about this inhaler? Is it effective or is it not effective? I think it was a change in the gold standard guidelines for COPD. And I was going through all these papers when I realized that the literature is not conclusive. Some papers said it's better than the previous inhaler and others papers said it's not better. So I went to my consultant and I said, what do I say? I don't know what to say. It's not conclusive, the research. I felt so lost. And he said, well, it depends how you interpret research papers, how the trials are designed. So then I went into learning that because I wanted to have something solid to hold on to, where I can go back to and refer and say, okay, this is a good treatment. This is what works. So I'm going to prescribe that. So I started doing that. But then in the fourth year of specialist training, I had a very, very, I don't know how to describe it, I fell in a hole. Let's put it that way. I fell in a hole. It was coincidentally twice in the same month, I was offered for my name to be put on a research paper which had been ghostwritten by the pharmaceutical industry. And because, I mean, if you're a trainee and you become a consultant, you want to have a post in a hospital, you need to have a good CV, which means that you need to have published papers.
Enticements, eh?
Yes. So,
wow.
So I was offered two times in the same month to put my name on a paper that would be published in a high standard medical journal. And I said, but I don't know anything about this child. I haven't done it. I don't know anything. Oh, please don't worry. Everything is fine. You don't have to do anything. And then I realized that how many people would do that because out of the need. Then I already knew I was going to the UK. I didn't want to stay in Spain, but so I didn't have the need to have a great CV just to stay at that hospital. But not only because of that, it was also like, I can't do it. It's against my ethics.
Ethically, yeah.
But how many people, even if it was against their ethics, would do it because of the necessity?
Hmm.
And there is no way to find these. If you read a research paper, there's no way to differentiate or to look behind the scenes, like, how is it written? How is it done?
Mm. Very interesting. There's two sides to that. That's one of them, as you say. You can't actually tell a genuine paper from one that's just been put together and is essentially a sales document. You can't tell that from a proper one very easily. Secondly, of course, if you'd have taken that step, that would have been the first tiny step down a road. What's the next thing you're going to be asked to do? And what's the enticement going to be? Where are you going to end up? And we've all seen that. It's all there, the history of these things, how people started off looking good and ended up just endorsing things that were harmful to people just because they could and they could get shed loads of money for it. And, extraordinary, really. It's such a corrupt mechanism. It should be impossible to do something like that, but it's not.
Yes, and it's very delicate because also there's so many genuine doctors publishing research and so many good professionals who want to help, but it's so hard to tell apart what is what.
Yeah, right, they're lost in the mass. Yeah, well, it's very disappointing that medicine's like that. There's so many. I've got personal stories to tell of my daughter was one of the first people to be prescribed OxyContin. New drug, fantastic, no side effects, no withdrawal. It's all wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And she had this for an amputation. And after she was having terrible side effects, And I went to the top surgeon at the Middlesex Hospital. I said, what's going on? Is this the cancer giving you side effects? Is it the drugs? He said, but it can't be the drugs. There aren't any side effects from those. And I thought, really? So I went away and I just put it into the search engine, side effects, OxyContin, and bam, there it all was. Hundreds of records of people suffering exactly the same side effects as my daughter. And basically that top surgeon, he hadn't read anything. He just listened to the salespeople, believed them, and doled it out. And look where OxyContin got. It actually took out millions of people's lives over 20 years and made extraordinary amounts of money with no science worth having at all. And just unbelievable, these stories that they can get away with this stuff and that our practitioners could be so untrustworthy.
Yes, that's very sad. And unfortunately, it's the truth. But we also should not make the mistake to generalize everything. We know
absolutely right.
Money drives the world. There is no way around that. But we should still go with faith, because so many good doctors are trying to do the best thing, and it's becoming more and more regulated now. It's still, I think there is a long way to go still, but it's becoming more and more regulated and more harder to bypass the route of having a clean research.
We need that. We need that. Yeah. No, I agree. There's no point in just turning into a kind of some kind of conspiracy theorist who says everything's bad. It's not. You know, yes, there are lots of people who are trying to do very good work. Absolutely.
It is difficult to publish because, for example, for my dissertation at the end of the master's degree in homeopathy, I did a pilot study, a clinical trial of 5 patients with a multi-resistant and permanent urine tract infection of patients who had a urine catheter, permanent catheter, and they were multi-resistant to all antibiotics. And it was a paper where we, on petri dishes, we analyzed the urine, the cultures, and we added different homeopathic medicines to the culture. And we saw that some of the bacteria cultures reverted to becoming sensitive again to the antibiotic, which is very interesting. And I'm not saying anything. I don't want to say that homeopathy cures infection or anything like that. I'm just saying that we could see objectively differences in the bacterial growth in those petri dishes where we had combined antibiotics with homeopathy, and that further research is needed. However, when I wanted to publish that paper, it was turned down by 4 journals. Because it wasn't science.
Yeah, no, that's because it was homeopathy. That's why.
They go with the placebo effect, but a petri dish doesn't have a
placebo effect in the petri dish. Very good, excellent. Yeah, no, well, not surprising. I mean, I could have put money on the fact they would have turned you down for that. But yeah, that's the power of the journals themselves, of course, who are funded by the pharmaceutical companies advertising. So. It is, as you say, money drives the world, and that's true there as well. Look, we've got a few minutes left. I just want to come round to you mentioned the third domain, if you like, of your patients, the soul. You described it as, some people might say, spirit. But do you want to say a bit more about that and what you're looking out for and how you think these people could be helped?
Yes. So I think the soul is very much linked to the mind. I don't know where to draw the line, because I think they go hand in hand with the body as well. But for example, it's when patients are diagnosed, the first thing they feel is fear. Many of them also have anger. Why me? It's unfair.
Yeah.
Resentment. Then maybe they link it to something that has happened. I don't know. Divorce, a loss of a child, or partner cheating, whatever, then they project that resentment towards that person. But it's harming them in the first instance. And it is so important, so vital to disconnect and detach from those negative emotions. And I know it's so easy to say, it's so easy for me to say it, and it can be so very much difficult for patients, but I see it over and over and over again. If patients can make the switch, if they can transit and let go of the negative emotions and forgive, make peace, or even find a spot where they're grateful for whatever has happened, they can do very good. I have one case of a patient diagnosed with melanoma, stage 4, metastasis everywhere. Immunotherapy didn't help. In the follow-up consultation, the oncologist said, well, immunotherapy is not helping, but it seems like it's slowing down the growth, even though the metastasis, all the lesions keep growing, and you're having so little side effects, just continue with the immunotherapy because I have nothing else to offer. The patient told me he went home, lied on the floor, and just accept it. Accepted the situation. Not I'm not talking about an acceptance from, oh, there's nothing else I can do. Mm-hmm. No, it's just now at this moment, this is what is. And was free from the past, free from the future, and decided to live every day, every moment in time. Now, very interestingly, all his lesions started to shrink. And this was 5.5 years ago, almost 6 years now. And he is in complete remission.
Yeah.
The oncologist has no clue what.
No, I bet.
No clue. But the patient is doing absolutely amazingly well. And this is, and now he is in the state of gratefulness, because he said that before that letting go, before of that enlightenment, he was stressed, full of fear, anger.
Yeah.
And now yeah. he is free of all of the negative emotions and he's living great.
Amazing. Well, those stories, they're more and more common these days, I'm glad to say. Things that are called, radical remissions or whatever, they're becoming commonplace, which means that people are doing something right. And that yeah. is a large part of it. I think you've just described there is people discovering there's another kind of life which is free from the baggage of the past and is free from the fear of the future. And it actually just allows them to actually be here and to enjoy the fruits of life as it is. And that's an extraordinary thing. And obviously what we're seeing is that to live in that way has the most remarkable effect on our biology as well. Is a sort of side effect, a good side effect of living in that way. I mean, there's no guarantee that somebody's going to get over cancer or whatever. But the one thing you can guarantee is that whatever length of life somebody has left to them, that is going to be a million times better than the one that they had before when they were tied down with all that stuff. So, that's an extraordinary thing to support people in finding. And something I'm passionate about and we're focusing on more and more is the kind of silver lining, if you like, of an opportunity a crisis can bring yes. to a human being when they actually stop everything that's going on and just have another look.
That's true. I find that's the biggest challenge, but also my biggest passion is to find the way to guide my patients to find that. That's
absolutely,
and it's different for everyone, but that's what tickles me. You know, when I speak with a patient, I'm just trying to sit down and receive their information, their energy, and trying to navigate them and guide them in the best way I can.
Fantastic. Yeah, well, that's what tickles me too. So anyway, great. All right, really exciting chat. Thank you very much, Saskia. We're out of time.
Thank you, Robin.
I think we've covered some great territory today. I'm sure people have found it interesting. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, Robin.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
As Dr. Kloppenburg mentioned, she works at the Royal London Hospital for Integrative Medicine, but she's available for online consultations also, and you can find out more details on her website, which is drkloppenburg.uk. So that's Dr. Kloppenburg, which is KLOPPENBURG.UK. If you found it interesting what Dr. Kloppenburg was saying about the potential of integrative medicine to address important aspects of the well-being of the mind and the spirit, then you won't want to miss the Yes to Life conferences this year, entitled Reclaiming Our True Nature. These two events both directly dive into this territory with some of the leading thinkers of today. The online conference is very soon, 16th of May, so don't lose any time in booking. And the in-person event is on the 26th of September in London. You can find out more and book for both events at conference.yestolife.org.uk. Delighted you joined me for this episode, and I hope you'll be back for more next week, when I'll be back to introduce another expert from the world of integrative medicine in the next Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.